Greetings, humans, living and dying in the Anthropocene. This is Jamming Their Transmission, where rebels, freaks, critics, dissidents, iconoclasts, and oddballs live. I'm your fellow traveler, John Madero. This is Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. The Association of Writers and Writing Programs Conference and Book Fair, colloquially known as AWP, is an annual destination for writers, editors, publishers, teachers, and students. The conference features over 2,000 presenters and over 500 readings, panels, and lectures. The book fair features over 800 presses, journals, and literary organizations from around the world. AWP is taking place in Portland, Oregon this year, March 27th through the 30th. I won't be there this year, alas, but today I'm happy to host a podcast of readings from a number of great writers who also won't be attending AWP this year, including Roz Morris, Tony Trujillo, Valerie Neiman, Chris Mazza, Callie Philandes, Seth Berg, and Michael A. Farrow.
Hello, my name is Roz Morris, and I'll be reading a piece from my travel memoir, Not Quite Lost, Travels Without a Sense of Direction. It was Easter Sunday. I was riding a horse through a back lane in the Surrey Hills when I came across a young man in hiking boots and a waterproof jacket standing at a finger post. He was trying to decide whether to walk along a single-track road between two sheep fields or another single-track road that led past a lone cottage into a bristling wood. "Can I help?" I asked. "I'm trying to get to West Humble." His voice rose anxiously as he pronounced the name, as if he feared I might tell him that West Humble didn't exist. West Humble did exist, but it was a few miles away. I was riding in that direction, so we walked together, me on my equine, him strolling beside. Travellers must have done this from time immemorial. "Where have you come from?" I said. "I've walked from Leatherhead Station, but I got lost. I've come to meet a girl I've been writing to." His face had a twinkle. The girl was special. But Leatherhead was quite a trek from the rural lane we were on. He must have been walking for at least an hour, and there was a much easier route, but it wouldn't help to tell him that. I said, "Couldn't she have picked you up?" He smiled nervously. "She doesn't know I'm coming. It's a surprise." Heavens, that sounded a bit risky. My horse is very tall. His sure, regular stride and my lofty position made me feel entitled to interrogate. "She doesn't know?" "I've never met her. We've been writing letters and emailing for 6 months. We get on very well, so I thought I'd come and visit her. I got out at Leatherhead Station and now I'm a bit lost." "You didn't bring a map?" "No, I live in Somerset." "Somerset. For those who don't know the UK, Somerset is more than 100 miles away. Quite a few more, in fact, and probably even further if you attempt the journey on Sunday trains. He must have been travelling since sunrise, on nothing more than a hunch." "What if she's out?" "She said she was spending Easter at home with her parents. They'll be having lunch now." "She was at home with her parents. I figured she had to be at school or college age, since they hadn't managed to meet already." He confirmed she was in the sixth form, and he was at catering college. "I really like her, so I thought I'd surprise her." Well, he could certainly be sure of that. I imagined how this would play. Doorbell rings. Who could that be? A parent goes to open it. "Kate," I imagined she'd be called Kate. "It's a boy, and he says he's come to meet you." Kate comes to the door. "Hi, it's me from the letters. But I thought you lived in Somerset." "Yes, I came all the way today. I've been walking for hours. I thought I'd surprise you." I said, "But what if she doesn't want to see you?" He wasn't fazed by the question. He must have already had that conversation with himself, in the hours on the trains, while walking the lanes in the endless countryside, questioning the very existence of West Humble. And now a voice was telling it to him, a voice floating down to him from a level above his head. But still he was walking. "I know, but I had to see. We get on really well." I rode with him to West Humble Station. I wished him well and watched him walk on, forever in that moment, in a bubble of determination and anticipation and hope, on the brink of romance. Thanks for listening. That piece was called I Came to Find Her. It's from Not Quite Lost, Travels Without a Sense of Direction. And it's by me, Ros Morris.
Hello, my name is Tony Trigilio, and I'll be reading a poem called The Gig Economy. The first thunderstorm of a snowy spring, I close my eyes, let the downpour do its work. Rainfall knows how to take over a room. Barack Obama and I are leaning against the driver's side of my car, the two of us watching workers stretch a long gray hose from a Chicago water and fire restoration van into my neighbor's building across the street. He looks like he did in 2004 when he toured my gym, another stop on his run for U.S. Senate. Jogging on the treadmill, I smiled back at him when he returned my nod. He shakes his head in the dream, preoccupied. His sleeves are rolled up, as they always were in the Oval Office. The stressed-out presidential gray hair is gone. He exudes the gravitas of a person who once ruled the free world, back when that was our quaint name for it. We used to be capitalists, he says, arms crossed, arching his back against the car window. Now we're all lobbyists. I have no idea what he means. Then he walks away. Everything in my neighbor's home is flooded, and now Obama is gone. Over the rumble of water hoses, I want to say, yes, I've read Four Things You Need to Thrive in the Gig Economy, and Four Reasons Why the Gig Economy Will Only Keep Growing in Numbers. I don't think he can hear me. I want to tell him about my cousins, afraid of their father, the drunken gig economy failure whose roadside produce stand wasn't productive enough to survive. But Obama's a block away, walking toward the lakefront. Corrugated hoses shake, pumping out floodwater. We didn't call it a gig or an economy back then. It was a wagon, trundling on warped struts, and my uncle fell off. We were raised to hate everything that wasn't food. He simply didn't sell enough.
Hello, my name is Valerie Neiman, and I'll be reading a poem entitled The Leopard Lady Tells Her Spots. The Leopard Lady Tells Her Spots. Don't be looking for what's daubed on that banner, the leopard lady naked in the jungle, brown skin all over with black spots like wallpaper on a wall. I'm more so like a spotted hound, or the rump of the Appaloosie our trick rider uses, white strode over dark. But truly, like the banner says, I am alive. Inside the tent, I rest on a high stool, wrapped in red, till the professor brings them round and spiels a story that ain't mine. I keep my back to the crowd, but they spy my hands, spotted like trout fish, resting on my shoulders. I hear them rustle and breathe. Then I let the silk slide down. Nothing there, one says out. My back is perfect brown, except for a patch on my backbone just above the spangly girdle I wear for modesty. But it's scarce that. The silk be whispering louder than them as the kimono falls and I turn and stand. They see me top to toe, all over speckled, face to breast to ankles, my affliction being such that where one side is marked, so will be the other. Here I am. Then the light dims down, the crowd shuffles along to see the terrible snake man of the Amazon, and I gather up my red to cover my nakedness.
My name is Chris Mazza, and I'll be reading a hybrid piece entitled Cliché Alert. Cliché alert. Not sure this can be expressed without them. A nightmare of colossal magnitude. Okay, just the facts, ma'am. Those had to be listed over and over to front desk, vet tech, ER vet, neurologist, next ER vet, next vet neuro. Memorized, but harder and tougher to say each time. Can't see keyboard through pooling, swollen eyes, typos in every word. Fix later. Digressing so the words won't get typed. If it's not written, maybe it's not real. Didn't happen. That shit, it did. He's gone. Best friend, partner, soulmate. There's your cliches. Just say it. He collapsed. 48 hours ago, middle of the night, heard him plod toward the water dish, maybe dragging feet. A telltale sound probably started days ago. Then the ka-thunk. Thought just down to sleep again. Fucking selfish bitch. Didn't check till my need to pee. Then he's in the way. Wouldn't move. Couldn't move. Swam on the tile floor. Lifted him, but legs like noodles crashed back down. Chin hit hard. Somehow that mysterious super strength could pick him up to race to the car, but couldn't do without his serrated wail. We'll never unhear it. But he never stopped recognizing me, knowing me, needing me, my slimy face hot and bloated, smelling of panic. 8 a.m., the 24-hour clinic's neurodoc already in emergency surgery on day off, then we'll leave. Have to go 50 miles further into the city, gurney to the car, load his floppy body. Another screech, fainter, another check-in, another ER doc, another vet neuro, now hours later. X-ray, pros and cons of MRI. There's something there in his neck. Yes, have known about that disc for years. Massive steroids for pain. But they disabled the immune system. That X-ray there could be tumor, could be infection. Limbs fully paralyzed, but pain, savage pain. Surgery has 50% success prediction. Try antibiotics, intravenous, leave him. Cold metal cage, fluids, opioids. Closes his eyes as his face is stroked, me kneeling on the floor for an hour, bent forward, a fetal pod people step over and around. The noise of the hospital blurs, glaring lights dim with my face against his shoulder. But an occasional whimper means he's being hurt. I'm hurting him. 24 hours of antibiotic proves the infection. Legs can swim again, but that's all. Would take days more, a week in the hospital, and probably wouldn't work. Surgery still the only hope, and still little hope of success. When I return in the morning, he recognizes, jerks, and heaves his head up, yowls, just a squeak. His chin lands in my lap and doesn't move from there again. Heavy, warm weight, trusting me, needing me. Decision has to be made, but the wait several hours until the doc can kneel here beside us and help me let him go. Fucking let him go. Fucking damn as though that's what he wants. He wanted to be helped, taken care of, and I couldn't, didn't. My fault. I didn't listen, wrapped in my own selfish woes. Just let his physical decay and malaise be the evidence of mine. I suck, and he found out, and you should know too.
Hi, my name is Callie Philandes, and I'll be reading a poem titled Tuesday. Misery like a white cloth over her shielded back. We are ugly under the bedroom light, ugly when we love each other, when we don't. Partial spirit appear on command. The thin skin of the self tightens, then later slips like I do. Like he, his glistening back, the only thing that holds the light as he enters, careful, the water does. Cream-colored horizon through my window, sound of rain all lifetime long. If he's holy, then you are. There's a chance, Marguerite, we will become tangerines and purse our lips like that for each other every evening. Velvet kisses, kindred and lonely, crackling fires over your childhood bookshelf. Come here, holy beast. I have something to show you. If it's evening and he's eating soup, singing an old tune, I believe you. If it's evening and he says, I love you, darling, toward the wintering window, I love you, my dear. Believe him. But covered in sleep like that, we cannot say he is not turning a single flower in his broken hand for me.
Hello, my name is Seth Berg. I'm going to be reading a poem called Aphasia. Aphasia. Ever since my wheelchair, I've been eating these placebos. Opalescent when I was a young man, and sometimes too large for my gag reflex. Now the nurse brings me tea and exotic fruits, chamomile and papaya. All I can do is raise my slow thumb and repeat the phrase, pretty good, because pretty good is universal, and the nurse will never know that inside this crippled head is an architect waiting to replace the severed sky.
Hello, my name is Michael A. Farrow, and I'm going to be reading a section from my debut novel, Title 13. The bus was rolling out of Chicago along through the afternoon sunlight when it came upon the outskirts of Gary, Indiana. The amber tint of a rusty fender could have been the city's calling color. There seemed to be little that remained of the post-war industrial steel city. Gary had seen its fortunes rise and fall throughout the 20th century at the south end of Lake Michigan. There were a number of factories and warehouses that from the highway appeared derelict and run down, yet the smokestacks that lined the tops of these buildings still belched some type of harsh gas into the air. It was never the smoke that caught Heald's eye, but the fire. Some of the stacks billowed out pure flame, burning off excess fumes, but to a passerby, it only made it seem all the more post-apocalyptic. The fires burned day and night, never ceasing to fill the sky above the factories. From the bus, it looked like the forgotten remnants of a ghost world. If Heald had been from any other part of the country, he might have been surprised by the landscape in Gary. But throughout the Midwest, ghost towns had become commonplace, just as they had in the Wild West over a century prior. The small communities often didn't last long once the resources dried up or railroads left. These days in the heartland, when the resources went, an entire industrial landscape became a haunted arena. There were still plenty of people in Gary, but they were overshadowed by the sheer vacuum. On the highway, you could see cars with people in them alongside you. But looking off into Gary at those massive fire-spewing pillars, there was scarcely a sign of human life, not even a sound. It was not fair, but it was now, more or less, a wasteland. A decomposing reminder of the Midwest's position within the Rust Belt, its flaming hopes monument to a ghost crew of laborers, still tending to the aging machines and furnaces, waiting, like birds on a wire, for something, anything, to happen. Years ago, while living in recession-ravaged Detroit, Heald decided to make his first trip ever to Chicago. He had never been to the Windy City, but had heard plenty about it. Chicago and Detroit are inextricably tied to each other as capitals of the Rust Belt. Heald knew that somewhere west of him at any time was this massive mecca of the Midwest. Like so many Americans in tough times before him, there was a growing sense within Heald that if he just stood at the top of a high peak and looked westward, he would see golden pastures that marked a new beginning. He felt like some old prospector infected by a sense of manifest destiny, with westward expansion being the only option for some semblance of success in life. It's the age-old reaction to an age-old problem. Pick up, move yourself elsewhere, and see if your problems follow you like a lonely dog. The hope is that they stay back and attach themselves to some other unfortunate soul. With that in mind, Heald set forth to explore. As the bus made its way along I-90, during that first trip to Chicago, Heald felt a rush of excitement that an optimism that he had not experienced in a long time. Along a massive multi-line expressway that leads into the city, There is a bridge over the Calumet River that gives the first glimpse of the incredible skyline. Hill wasn't expecting for it to appear so soon after crossing the state border from Indiana into Illinois. But as the bus drove over the bridge, Hill leaned close to his window and got his first look at that awe-inspiring row of dynamic steel edifices rising from the earth. He remembered sunlight everywhere, and as he gazed at the glint off the vibrant mirrored structures, he thought he had spotted a glowing golden nugget. Few young people have come across this site and not been taken aback. The buildings looked new, the city expanding by the moment as the bus drew closer. They rounded the lake and made their way up north to Dan Ryan, the immense monolithic Sears Tower guiding them in like a beacon on some intellectual shoreline.
This is Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. You've been listening to Roz Morris, Tony Trujillo, Valerie Neiman, Chris Mazza, Callie Philandes, Seth Berg, and Michael A. Farrow, reading from their writing. Thanks to all the writers for appearing on Jamming Their Transmission. That does it for our show. Thanks for listening to Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. Until next time, and always, be the strange you wish to see in the world.